Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego.
All right. Good morning, everybody. And thank you, Larry, for that great song service. That last one especially is one that I just love. Be Thou My Vision. If you haven't spent much time with that song, I encourage you to go back and look through the words there. That's a really, really inspiring song. I love that song. And thank you for doing that reading, too. Part of the reason why I love doing the reading before I get up here is because I think it helps us in our mind. The other reason is that then I don't have to get through the difficult names. So so thanks for that. Thanks for jumping on that grenade for me. It's good. Okay, so welcome. It's really wonderful to see all of you here this morning, and I am very excited to be here because we are getting into the book of Daniel. We're going to be studying the book of Daniel throughout the majority of September. We'll have somebody else speaking for us at the very end of September, so they may continue. Of course, at that point, we'll be in the last half of Daniel, which will be a little bit more difficult, where it gets a bit more figurative. So if whoever that's going to be, I imagine it'll be Brendan, you can make that decision. But and Daniel is one of my favorites. I imagine that has a lot to do with our VBS programs and things like that. But I love the book of Daniel. I love the book of Daniel. And as we get through some of these stories over the next 4 weeks, I hope if you don't love the book of Daniel, maybe you'll come to love it. I love all the books of the Bible, but this one especially, it's fantastic. And the reason for that is that this is a book that is so incredibly relevant to our lives, so incredibly relevant. And in order for us to really understand the significance of that, what I want us to do this morning, before we do anything else, is to acknowledge that what we're doing in this time here is really odd. Okay, it's really odd. The latest date that scholars will, even the most skeptical sort of scholars, will give the book of Daniel, somewhere around 200 or so BC, right? Around 200 or so BC when it reaches its final form, which means that at the very least, the book that we have sitting in front of us today, the book that we're going to be jumping into this month, is over 2,000 years old. 2,000 years old. People have been reading this book here for 2,000 years. And in a world that is so focused on newness, and in a world in which we're increasingly, and much to our demise, like throwing off the wisdom of those older than us, what could this book that's over 2,000 years old possibly share with us? What could it possibly give our lives? How might it cause us to look at our lives in a different way? How might it help us? But when we get into the book of Daniel, I think what we're going to find is that this is a book of supreme relevance. Supreme relevance. It's one that's been on my mind recently, and I just can't wait to get into it. So what we're going to do this morning is we're going to kind of introduce this series a little bit by getting into its context a little bit and to sort of hit that relevance home. And then we're going to look at Daniel's actions and God's actions here in the first chapter. So first of all, how is Daniel relevant? How is Daniel relevant? Well, first of all, what we find here, there are three things that we see in this passage that that Larry just read for us. There are three things. First of all, that adds to the relevance, is that this is a book that takes place in the land of Shinar. The land of Shinar. Now, look at verse 2 here. We know that this is happening during the Babylonian exile, and if you aren't familiar with Israelite history, this is a portion of their history in which the southern kingdom of Judah has been holding out for a long time, but now Nebuchadnezzar has come, and he's, at this point, he's sort of destroyed the city, he's destroyed the temple, and he's taken back a portion of the people to what they call in verse 2 the land of Shinar. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Now, the reason why this is so interesting, this land of Shinar, and the reason why we need to pay attention to this here for a second, is that this place didn't exist. This place didn't exist in this time. It's really interesting. It existed, but nobody had called it this for a very long time. It would be a little like if you went on vacation to like Montana, and then you got back and you were telling your friend about it, and you said, me and my family, we had a great time. We went on vacation. We went to the Nebraska Territory, right? Where it's like the land still exists. The land is there, obviously, but it hasn't been called that for like 150 years or something like that. And so what is this land of Shinar? It shows up a couple times in our Bible. I'm going to show you the first place, or one of the first places that it shows up. Now, the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had bricks for stone and bitumen and for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its tops in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." All right, name that Bible story. Yeah, Tower of Babel. You got it, yeah. Tower of Babel. This is the very first place that this city, that this place, this area, shows up in our Bibles, the Tower of Babel. And from here onward, from Genesis chapter 11, it shows up one more time in chapter 10, but in a sort of minor way. From then on, whenever the biblical authors sort of refer to this land of Shinar, there's a sort of a taste of a flavor of this story that gets carried over, right? And they're sort of making reference back to here. And so here, in the book of Daniel, this land, this like piece of Mesopotamia, it hasn't been called the land of Shinar for hundreds of years, right? Like politically, it's not the land of Shinar, but they're referring to it as the land of Shinar. And what are they saying when they're doing this? Essentially, this land of Shinar comes to be sort of a type, right? And it stands for a land of extreme pride, right? A land of extreme pride and a place that sort of spits in the face of God, right? A place that thinks too much of itself, right? And does this sound familiar to you, a place like this, right? A place of immense power and strength but used poorly, right? It's a land of pride. So first of all, when we find Daniel, he's in the land of Shinar. He's an exile in this place of great pride, in this place that spits in the face of God. It's the first thing we need to know. The second thing here that we see in this first little passage that we had read for us is that each of these exiles, as they live in this land, they're given new names. So if you look down in verse 6, among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah of the tribe of Judah, and the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. Okay. Now, this is actually a really common practice. This seems like an odd thing, and this doesn't seem like the type of practice that would be maybe very relevant to us, but I think it is, because this is a common practice in exile, and the purpose of doing this is to sort of display a new ownership, right? To display a new ownership. So it's sort of like in Stratford, we have one Chinese restaurant. But we don't just have one Chinese restaurant, because it's been like seven different Chinese restaurants. It's like this little cinder block building that sits in the parking lot of a grocery store. It's like one of those places. And since I was in high school, it's had like four or five different names. And the reason for that is because it keeps getting shut down by the health department, you know. And every time, you know, they swap the name out, you know, to sort of to mark a point and a break in the ownership, right? To say, like, we're not, like, you know, Chinese Chef or whatever. We're Cashew Inn, you know, to do that sort of thing, right? It marks a point in ownership. We still do this today, but that's not where it's relevant, because the names that they give them are really interesting. And here are a couple of these. This shows up in a couple different places in the Second Temple literature, this portion of the Bible. So Daniel, his name means something like, God is my judge, right? God is my judge. But they rename him Belteshazzar, which means something like, Bel protects my life, right? This foreign god, Bel protects my life. And Mishael, whose name means, who is like God, they rename Abednego, or servant of Nabu. This is another one of the gods of Mesopotamia. And then this is not actually from the story, but this is another example of where this shows up in Second Temple literature. So Esther, we all know the story of Esther. Did you know that's actually the story of Hadassah, right? Her Jewish name? Hadassah, which means bride, right? And they change her name to Esther, which is sort of a cognate, sounds like Ishtar, which is the god of fertility, the god of sex, and this they name her after this god. Now, what you'll notice here as you look at these names is that this name change, it represents a change in ownership, right? As Babylon has come in and they've exiled these people. But with each of these names, it carries an expectation, doesn't it? Right? Servant of Nabu, right? It carries an expectation. And the reason why I think this is important is because I think this... this concept kind of carries over to our lives. Because I have an understanding of my identity. I know who I am, and I have expectations for how I should live my life. But sometimes, it's like I go to school, for example, I get the sense that everybody around me, that my world, has a different idea about what my identity is, and that they have different expectations about how I should live my life, right? And sometimes, as a Christian, living in our world, living in this like exiled place, living in Shinar, it can feel like we're struggling between two identities, between two different names, right? That when we're here, when we're in our, like, when we're in this safe place together, we know who we are, right? We have an identity, we have an expectation for one another, but then as we enter our world has a very different expectation for us and very different ideas about who we are. And they'll try to force those ideas on us, right? And so this is, I think, maybe more relevant than we think it is. And there's one more thing here that I'd like to touch on as well. One more piece of context before we'll have a brief thought from Daniel chapter 1. And that is that while these exiles who have been renamed and drug off to this land of pride and power, as they've done this, they are going to undergo training. Let's look at verse 3 here. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank, and they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Now, this is a really common practice in the ancient Near East, because a lot of times when we think about these wars, it wouldn't be profitable for Babylon to come in, or for Persia to come in and just like destroy everything and kill all of the people, because you get land, but then you're not actually getting that much stronger because you don't have, it's not like you have any bigger of a population. And so what they would do is they would go into a place, right? And they'd maybe destroy the city, right? And really break the people down. But then they would take the best and the brightest from that city, and they would take them back to their home, right? And they would educate them. And then the purpose of this was that you would take somebody, you would take a local person, you take them to your home, and you would teach them all about how to be a good Chaldean, right? How to be a good Babylonian, right? You teach them your myths, and you teach them your ways, your laws, and everything. And the idea was that then if they were really good, you could keep them there in your hometown, or more likely, you would send them back, right? Because the locals would accept them, and then they would lead, right? Sort of in your stead. And you would trust that these people who had been taken from their home, whom you had educated, would then lead their people with your interests in mind. Right? And the reason why this is important, I think, is because our world still does this. Our world still does this. And we can't allow our world to mold the leaders and future leaders of our church. Instead, we must create congregations. We must be a congregation that creates the leaders and future leaders of our world, as opposed to vice versa, right? And so here we have it. This is the book of Daniel. Daniel and his friends have been taken from their home. Their temple has been destroyed, right? They feel like they're far away from God. They're in this land of great power that's been used poorly. They're in this land of incredible pride, this land of these people that spit in the face of God. They've been given new names, right? The people around them have different expectations for them and have different ideas about who they are and their identity. And they are constantly facing this pressure to learn and then, forget who they are, right? And to act with the best interest in mind of their captors. This is the world that we inhabit, both in this story and in our lives. And these are the questions that we have to come to grips with as we live in exile. And some of these questions that we're going to be looking at, especially today, but as we go, are like, how do we live in this kind of a world? How do we live? And today what we're going to talk about are like drawing boundaries, right? And when we live in this kind of world, as we do every day, we have all sorts of like important questions that come to our mind. They're ones that I want to address. Of like, how active do I be in this world? You know, like, do I completely remove myself from it? Do we just like lock the doors here and like stay in this building, or do we like completely conform to the ways of our world? Like, what do we do? And like, what kind of places can we work, right? When is an environment too negative and having too negative an impact on us that we have to remove ourselves from that? Or like, what movies do we watch and things like that? Or like, do we send our kids to school or do we keep them at? And like, all of these questions, they center around the question of how do we figure out how to live in this world in exile. And that's a question that I want to answer in a very small way today, and it's a question that we'll be looking at through the remainder of this month. Now, if you would, if you haven't already, turn over to Daniel chapter 1. We're going to read the remainder of this chapter, and I'm just going to bring out just a couple things to maybe help us think about this. Beginning in verse 8, "But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food, or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who has assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you were in the worse, that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then let our appearances and the appearances of the youth who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables, which feels like it should be a win, right? But that doesn't, it doesn't quite feel like a win, being given vegetables. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all wisdom and literature. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and all dreams. And at the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none were found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Now we're going to look at three things very, very briefly, I promise, today. We're going to look at Daniel's action, God's response, and the combined impact of these two. First of all, Daniel's action. In verse 8, we see that Daniel draws a line. And in verse 8, he says that he resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food and with the wine that he drank. Now, there is a, we don't have time to get into this, but there is what I would call a vicious, vicious nerd fight that is happening in the world of biblical studies and has been for a very long time as to what on earth that means, that Daniel doesn't want to defile himself with the food. And there are all sorts of different explanations, all of which have their own problems. And if you want to know more about that, please come and talk to me afterwards, because I would love to talk about it. But I won't throw that on you this morning. It could be that somehow this food doesn't conform to like the Jewish laws about food, but then that doesn't exactly work because, you know, he has a problem with the wine, which never gets brought up. And then in chapter 10, he's eating this food, and there. It could have been that the food was offered to idols, but then it's, you know, the vegetables probably would have been as well. So there's a whole thing going on here, but it doesn't really matter because the action is the same, and it's motivated by the same desire to please God, and that is that Daniel, as he's in this world, he draws a line. He makes a boundary. He decides that he does not want to be defiled by the food. He decides that he wants to please God in his action, and he draws a line. And there are a couple things that are significant about this. First of all, it's significant because Daniel's world is much like our own. And as much as he's expected to compartmentalize his faith, right? Do you ever feel that? We're supposed to compartmentalize our faith, that we can be, that our world allows us to be a Christian on Sundays and maybe on Wednesdays. But then during the week, as we live in our world, as we go to school or go to work or wherever we're at, that we're expected to behave in ways that are according to the best interests of our world. And we are expected in a lot of ways to compartmentalize our faith. And this is the same case with Daniel. But Daniel is unwilling to do that. Daniel is unwilling to do that. And it's significant that he's unwilling to do that because at this point, God has still been silent, right? Now, Daniel, he's seen, like, the destruction of his city. He's seen the fact that he's living in this other land points to the, for him, maybe points to the fact that his God has been defeated, or at least that his God has been absent and allowed him to be drug off here. And God has really yet to speak to Daniel and yet to move in his life in a major way yet in the story. But Daniel, He resolves that he will not be defiled, and he draws a line. He refuses to compartmentalize his faith. And it seems small. This seems like a small action. But in many ways, he's also putting his life at great personal risk. Look at the response that the eunuch has, right? And verse 10, "I fear the Lord, my king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king." In other words, what he's saying is like, I'm afraid that if you refuse this food that the king is graciously giving you, and that you wind up skinnier and unhealthy, right? That the king will come and he will cut my head off, right? And he's the chief of the eunuchs. And so, like, if the king is willing to, like, cut off the head of, like, the chief of the eunuchs, he's definitely willing to cut off the head of the, like, Israelite exile that's causing problems with the food, right? And so in a lot of ways, too, Daniel's taking the stand at great personal risk. At great personal risk. And Daniel is unwilling to get ahead or to keep pace. He's unwilling to get ahead at the expense of his faith. And it may not seem like we have these same opportunities or that God, you know, asks us to stand up for our faith in these ways that put our life in danger. But I think with every moment that we make these decisions and draw these lines that are in line with our faith and choose to love and to follow God, I think we are giving up portions of our life, right? We're not getting our heads cut off, right? But I think we are giving up portions of our life. And the other thing I think that's significant about this, too, is, again, that Daniel, he doesn't have a set reason, I don't think, for why he draws the line here. He has his reasoning, but we can't tell what it is. And I think, I don't know, this is something that we can relate to. Because for us, we know that when it comes to interacting with our world, we have to draw boundaries somewhere. We have to draw lines somewhere. And we don't always have a biblical precedent for that, right? Because, like, there isn't a straightforward answer in the Bible all the time for, like, the small specific ways that we draw our lines, right? And the way that I draw my lines may be different from the way that you draw your lines, but I think that the one thing that we have to stick to is that we have a reason for doing the things that we do, right? And if it's the decisions about the movies that we watch is something as small as that, my line may be different from your line, but we have to have a reason for that, why we do that. And if it is the jobs that we take, the environment that we put ourselves in, or the environment that we allow our children to be put in, sometimes there isn't a straightforward answer about how we should draw those lines. But one thing is clear, and that is that we should have some sort of reasoning for that. And that our reasoning should be that we have, with our God-given wisdom, come to the conclusion that this is how we best serve God. This is where we draw our lines. Now, how does God respond to this? Look in verse 9 here. He does in two ways. First of all, in verse 9, God gives Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And so what we discover, first of all, is that as we draw these lines, wherever we draw them, as we make boundaries between ourselves and our world, that God helps to facilitate that process, and we can trust that he is going to strengthen us to do that. But second of all, and this is probably most interesting, in verse 17, "As for the four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams." Now, this is really, really interesting. Because in this story, we see kind of two forces at work. On the one hand, Daniel is all about drawing lines, right? He's drawing boundaries. He's making barriers between him and his world. He's saying, okay, I'll go this far. I'll let you change my name or whatever, but I will not eat the food, right? And he's drawing boundaries. But God is pushing him further into his world. Did you notice in verse 17, right? He gives them all wisdom and all learning and skill in the literature and in the wisdom and understanding and all visions. And at the end of this time, when they're brought all together, it's found that like none of them, none of these other youths, none of these other people are as skilled in the literature and the wisdom of Babylon as Daniel and his friends. Now, what's interesting about this is that like a person in Daniel's position, a person who was going to be a partially a scribe, but then also like an advisor to the king, when it talks about him learning the wisdom and the literature, it means that he's reading things like Enuma Elish, right? And the Epic of Gilgamesh, and he's learning these like Babylonian laws, and we have thousands and thousands of practice tablets from Mesopotamia, where people like Daniel were brought in to learn the literature, and what they would do is they would read the stories, and then they would sort of like write them down as they went, and they would read the laws of Babylon, and then they would recite from memory like the laws of Babylon, right? And so Daniel is somebody who at the end of these 3 years, he has done a better job of doing this than any of his other peers, right? And this is so fascinating. Because on the one hand, Daniel is all about drawing boundaries, right, and putting up barriers. But God is pushing him further into his world, right, and saying, no, you can't just, like, keep the world at arm's length, right? I want you to actually be immersed in this culture in order to have an impact. And as we read this, we have certain passages in mind. For instance, Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Right? In other words, what Jesus is saying there is that the light that you have in you has a purpose, right? And I don't want you to just like lock the doors of your church building and never go out into your world, right? I want you to be immersed in your culture. I want you to live there, right? You may think of Jeremiah chapter 29 when he's telling the exiles, you know, build a house, right? And have a family, right? And have jobs and like live in the city and seek the welfare of the city, because you'll find your welfare attached to the welfare of the city. God wants his people to be on the one hand, he wants them to draw boundaries and draw lines and retain their identity. And on the other hand, he wants them to be fully immersed in their culture. Right? This is sort of the balance. This is the dual nature. And the reason for this, I want to conclude with this point here. There's a reason for this. And we'll get into the story next week in chapter 2. But the reason why all of this happens, the reason why God wants him to be both fully immersed and to keep his identity, it comes up in chapter 2, because in chapter 2 we hear that Nebuchadnezzar has a dream that the king of Babylon, this great and mighty figure in history, this most powerful figure in the world at this time, he has a dream. And we'll get into this next week, but he's seeking the truth. He wants somebody to tell him the truth of this dream. And what Daniel discovers, and what we discover as we read it, is that because Daniel has drawn certain lines to maintain his identity, and because God has pushed him to be fully immersed in that culture, because he's been both of those things, Daniel gets put in this unique position where he is the only person in Nebuchadnezzar's life that can tell him the truth. The only person. And what I want us to think about this morning is that, okay, All of us here, we have different contexts, and we'll get into this next week. Some of you work in the medical field, right? Some of you work in the medical field. And if you're like Sean and you work in the medical field, you know that language, right? You know that culture, right? You know what it's like to pull 12-hour shifts. You know how heartbreaking it is to work with people in that kind of environment, and you know that world. You know that life. And I don't. I have no idea what that life is like. I don't know that language. I'm not immersed in that culture. And because you, and because many of you, and all of you, in your various paths, in your various lives, because you have retained your identity in that place, and because you have become fully immersed in that culture, there are people that you work with, or the people that you go to school with, or people in your families, for whom you are the only person in their life to tell them the truth. Right? The truth that they want to hear, and the truth that maybe they don't want to hear. And that has a dual nature to it as well. That's a blessing, because all of us know that in this room we have importance. And it's also really concerning, because there's a lot of pressure there. But that's something I want us to think about. And I hope that that's a calling and a mission field that we'll maybe take up. All of us have a responsibility in our lives. As we live in our world, in this land of great pride, all of us have the responsibility to use the wisdom that God has given us to both draw boundaries and to know when to set boundaries between us and our world, and to know when and how to safely become immersed in our culture such that we can impact people and that we don't hide our light. And I hope that that's clear. This morning, this is where we're at. I'm looking forward to getting through the rest of Daniel with you. This morning, if you haven't begun a life with Christ and you would like to put him on in baptism, or if you would like to renew your journey with him by coming forward and by having us pray for you or whatever that looks like, we ask you to please do that while we stand and sing.